This episode is brought to you by Klaviyo. Did you know that top brands drive 50% of their e-commerce revenue with Klaviyo? Consolidate your channels, including email, SMS, mobile push, and reviews, and centralize and use data from across your tech stack to grow your business and revenue faster and more efficiently than ever. Power smarter digital relationships with the platform built for e-commerce. To learn more, head to klaviyo.com/glossy. That's klaviyo.com/glossy. Hello, and welcome back to the Glossy Week in Review podcast. I'm your host, senior fashion reporter Danny Parisi, and I'm here with our international reporter, Zofia Zviglinska. Hello, Zofia.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. And thank you for tipping me off. We record this Thursday morning. I had written a whole thing about Pier Paolo Piccioli leaving Valentino and who was going to take over and speculating all these names. And then 30 minutes before the recording, Zofia let me know that Alessandro Michele had been officially confirmed as the new creative director. So we will obviously be talking about that. We'll also dig into H&M's earnings from this week and some of the indications of where their strategy is going. And then finally, we'll talk about ASOS and Boohoo, two UK brands who had to sign an agreement this week over greenwashing claims and how they're going to market their sustainability. So we'll get into that as well, which is something you and I, Zofia, I think both have strong opinions on. But let's start with Alessandro to Valentino. So I'm going to start with like what I had originally written before this was announced, which was Pier Paolo Piccioli stepped down seemingly kind of abruptly last week, I believe, from Valentino. He still had shows coming up in June. There was a menswear show and a haute couture show coming up, which were both canceled because he was stepping down. I was going to go into a whole thing about how creative director, you know, departures are happening more frequently. There's lots of brands losing their creative directors. Dries Van Noten just left. I think Alexander McQueen lost their creative director recently as well. And a lot of times when they step down, there's kind of this interim period where they don't have a strong creative, you know, mind leading things. And sometimes the brands are up in the air for a while. And then, like I said, the confirmation of Pier Paolo's replacement came very quickly. Alessandro Michele, formerly of Gucci, and kind of just floating around the last couple months since leaving Gucci, is the new creative director of Valentino. So I have thoughts on that fit, but why don't you go first, Zofia? What do you think of that move?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very kind of obvious one. He is someone who has a very strong kind of creative outlook. And I think that, you know, he's someone who's always worked very well with archives, whether that's with Gucci and kind of recalling some of the older designs that were very popular, you know, from back in like the 80s and 90s. I think that with Valentino's archives, it's going to be a very kind of similar thing where he's going to be able to bring up some of the more iconic pieces from, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, and reinvent them for the modern age. The only thing is that obviously, like towards the end of his tenure at Gucci, you know, he was basically kind of making more and more of the same. So I'm wondering if he's going to be able to kind of keep up and create a new direction that will be constantly updated as is kind of necessary with the seasonal collections that are happening in fashion right now.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think I feel the same as you. Obviously, Michele is known for this sort of maximalist style at Gucci, like really loud and bold, which is not quite the same vibe as Valentino. But I also feel like it makes sense. I mean, I think he's capable of elegance. There was a lot of designs that he did at Gucci that I thought, in addition to being kind of loud and vibrant, also could be understated and elegant in the way that I think Valentino kind of specializes in. So I think that makes sense. It's also interesting that he's ending up back at a Kering affiliated brand because Gucci is owned by Kering and Kering owns, I think, a 30% stake in Valentino. So it's not fully owned. And, you know, given how powerful the conglomerates like LVMH and Kering and Richemont are, I was wondering if he would maybe, you know, after spending many years working for a big conglomerate brand, want to maybe go somewhere more independent, maybe work with a smaller brand. But he's back working with Kering again. So they must have been still happy or confident with his abilities just at a different brand. That's my take on that. I don't know, Zofia, do you have any thoughts on where you thought Alessandro might have ended up, and is it surprising that he's back at a big house?
Yeah, a little bit. I actually thought he would take up some of his own creative projects, and I'm surprised that he didn't, but he does have, you know, I think it's been a year since his departure from Gucci. I can't remember exactly. But I think that, you know, that's a good amount of time to start something new. And I think if he was considering that path, he would have done it by now. So I'm assuming he was just waiting it out for the best offer and for the best opportunity. And I'm wondering if visibility after the Gucci run would actually help him kind of launch something which would be a little bit more kind of his own or successful. You know, it's something that would give him a little bit more of a platform.
Yeah, but we also know that starting your own house is extremely difficult. You know, the only like really big, new, major, high luxury house that I can think of recently to launch is Phoebe Philo. And even that, I think, has been, you know, it required an extreme mega star like her to kind of get it off the ground. And it's still kind of like just, you know, revving up slowly. So I think he could get away with starting his own thing, but it's just really difficult. And, you know, we've talked about it on this podcast a lot, but more and more luxury brands are being kind of sucked up into the LVMH, Kering, Richemont, a little bit Tapestry, especially once they go through with this Capri Holdings deal. But the conglomerates really kind of hold a lot of sway over luxury. So it's really difficult for independent brands, I think, to get to the same level. Cool. Any other thoughts on Alessandro before we move on?
Yeah, I'm interested to see how he's going to work with the current owners of Valentino. Because obviously, I believe it's Mehula, his Middle Eastern company who owns Valentino at the moment, what that's going to look like. I mean, if Kering is calling the shots when it comes to, you know, the creative direction, you know, how involved are they? And is that something that's kind of going to continue? I believe that they own 30% now, but there is a possibility of a buyback in a couple of years. So, you know, I'm wondering if Alessandro is actually thinking about a more long-term future at Valentino, you know, a good couple of years, which again is quite rare in the industry nowadays. You know, creative directors don't tend to stay for a very long time, unless you're, you know, Maria Grazia Chiuri, obviously.
Yeah. Or if you own the brand, or if you're involved in the brand in some way beyond just being a creative director, you know, like Dries Van Noten was there for a super long time. But if you, yeah, like you said, if you're an independent, you know, person who comes in just as creative director, I think it's very, the tenures are getting shorter. You know, we've got, there have been people who have been at brands for less than a year or even just a couple of months, one or two collections, and then they're out. So, yeah, I'm interested to see how long Alessandro Michele stays at Valentino and how, if he'll be given the, I mean, he's got such credibility in the industry, so the answer is probably yes, but I wonder if they'll give him the time to really develop his version of Valentino, or if it's going to be, if they don't see immediate good results in 1 year, he's just out. I don't know. I think he's earned enough credit to be given some more time, but we'll see. Let's move on to our second topic. I want to talk about H&M's earnings. So H&M reported extremely good earnings this week. Their revenue grew by 14%, way above analyst expectations. Their profit margin grew a lot. It's the first earnings report, I believe, under their new CEO, Daniel Erver. He has put a big emphasis on strengthening sales, cutting costs, improving profitability, all these things that they very clearly did. But one thing that I'm observing is they're kind of moving toward a faster version of fast fashion. They've always been kind of a fast fashion brand, but you know, they talked about how prices are going to be lower, they're going to be selling faster. They've always had a big mountain of inventory to sell through that's been really tough for them, and so I think because of the pressure from Zara or Shein and those kinds of places, that it seems like they're trending toward lower prices and quicker turnarounds, which is the epitome of fast fashion. So I wonder what that will do to them long term. It's certainly good in the short term for this quarter. They sold more and their revenue was up. That's always good for the shareholders. But I wonder what long term effect that will have on the company. What's your take, Zofia?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been hearing something different, which is that they're kind of cost right-sizing their assortment. So basically some of their assortment, according to, you know, some of the things that Eva said, was not priced correctly. And now that it has, it's kind of showing returns based on those numbers. So I'm wondering if, you know, and this is just me being very kind of sneaky on the side, thinking about AI and how it's being used. I talked to some people saying that, you know, that is a big way that you can kind of see what your competitors are doing and therefore kind of price products appropriately or change prices depending on the season, because that's also something that brands do if you don't know that. And I think that that is something that H&M is doing now, which is basically pricing their assortment correctly and therefore kind of seeing the returns there. But they've had some, yeah, they've had some real issues. They had some, like, the impact of the Suez Canal thing was happening with them. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a big thing. So it's good that they're kind of out of the weeds now, and it looks like they're on a path to growth. It's surprising that they're not going down this route of premium kind of fast fashion, which is what's happening with, like, Zara and some of the other brands. I think that Inditex is definitely leaning towards kind of having a higher end assortment of things. And I believe there's a new shop that opened from H&M in Bond Street this week that's supposed to have a kind of more premium assortment. And they have been testing some other retail concepts which are kind of leaning into more of that kind of premium assortment feel. I think in New York, Soho, they've got a store which, like, sells, like, secondhand vintage items now that they're testing. So yeah, there's some interesting kind of experiments happening. I'm hoping that it all kind of works out for them, but they were quite far behind. So yeah, I'll see if they kind of catch up.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right that for a fast fashion or just mass apparel kind of brand, you've kind of got two options. You can either go the Zara route, which is sort of try to premiumify the brand, maybe raise prices, put more, you know, do a little bit less inventory, which I think H&M has been doing. Like you said, they decreased their inventory by 7% last year. Or you can go the Shein route, which is just fully embrace, it's going to be dirt cheap and we're going to sell 5 million like versions of this shirt or something. And I feel like H&M is a little bit in between those two models at the moment. The fact that they talked on their earnings about the prices being lower through the end of the year, which I'm not sure if they were talking discounts or if they're talking like actual price changes, like retail price changes, it might be a little bit of both. That's what made me think that they might be thinking more toward that Shein route. But like you said, they might be doing both. They might be trying to split the business a little bit and, you know, have the really cheap, really fast selling stuff for the Shein crowd and then also kind of have these premium outlets for people who want something else. So, but I feel like a lot of brands know that it sounds better to say that they're doing slower fashion and being more considerate and stuff. And then they see, you know, brands like Shein doing insanely well and they kind of like scramble to just try and do that. It's not as good. It's not as like good press to say, yeah, we're going to sell dirt cheap stuff. And, you know, it doesn't sound as good to say, but I feel like every brand is seeing how successful that is, especially, you know, the H&Ms and Uniqlo's and those brands that are kind of already in a similar space anyway, doing extremely high volume and affordable prices. So I don't know if I'm not sure if we'll see H&M go fully down that path, or maybe they'll figure out some way to do a little bit of both.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I had two more points on that is that, you know, I think it was this week that Shein came out that they're actually basically licensing their business model to brands, which means that, you know, for brands that are maybe not as, you know, into AI and kind of the developments in that space, they'll be able to get that at, you know, a membership price discount or something like that, and be able to buy into that kind of type of business model, which again would be really bad for sustainability. And sustainability is actually that something that H&M has been pushing for quite a number of years now. You know, until very recently, it was one of the main backers of RenewCell. Like, they've been doing a lot of recycled materials, kind of composition work. I think that's something that they also mentioned on the earnings, that, you know, sustainability is still a kind of big topic for them. So I'm wondering how they're going to be able to roll that out going forward, kind of maintaining this idea that they're one of the big, let's say, fast fashion players. in the sustainability space, but at the same time, you know, trying to get those sales up and the revenue. And I think that, you know, that's when the idea of kind of different revenue streams really comes in, because I think a lot of these major brands haven't really looked at service offerings or adding in different kind of services. I think Uniqlo is the only one who's got like repairs and customization as a kind of alternative revenue stream to sales. So I'm wondering if they're going to do anything with that, or if they're going to look into some other propositions, because they do have quite a few brands under the H&M group, along with like Arket and some of the others. So they might have other brands where they want to test that first.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely right. And speaking of, you know, sustainability at these kinds of brands, our third topic is sort of related, but ASOS and Boohoo, both are UK brands that I would describe as sort of fast fashion-y. This week, the UK's Competition and Markets Authority announced that ASOS and Boohoo have both signed a binding agreement to change the way they market their sustainability. So specifically, it means they'll refrain from using sort of vague and misleading language, including things like calling something sustainable but not really explaining how it's sustainable or ethical. And also stuff, the one that drives me crazy is like putting a little green leaf next to a product and then with no explanation of what that means. But obviously every consumer is going to see that and think that it's indicating some sort of sustainable, climate friendly kind of thing. But you can just put that on there and like there's very few rules about what that means. So I feel like you and I have talked about this quite a lot, about how loose it can be in the fashion industry globally. It differs by country and market, obviously, but generally speaking, I think that the fashion industry is much looser with what you're allowed to say about your clothes than compared to, say, what you could say about the food you sell. If you, you know, you have to give specific nutrition facts if you're selling any type of food, whereas in fashion, there's like not quite as strict rules about what you can say. So greenwashing obviously is a huge thing. We mentioned earlier, brands know what they should say and they know what sounds good to say, but it doesn't always line up with what they're doing. So you've written about this a lot, Zofia. What's your take on this agreement?
Yeah, I mean, the Competition Markets Authority, which is the kind of organization who looked into ASOS and Boohoo in 2022, actually found that there was possible greenwashing during an kind of initial review, which prompted this action from them. And I do think that it's very indicative of the fact that at least on the sustainability front, on the most part, the UK is kind of aligned with what the EU is doing and being quite tough on brands who are greenwashing. And I think that it's very important that, you know, all of that marketing language is looked at. You know, in Europe, it's a very kind of big thing, obviously less so in the States, but I do think it's kind of coming along as well, that the importance of having accurate and most importantly, a kind of dialogue between sustainability and marketing teams will actually help brands because of the fact that they won't end up having to pay fines or be penalized in such a way where, you know, they're kind of brought out and named and shamed. So some of the things that they're going to have to do include, like, they're going to have to make statements regarding fabrics. So they can't just say this is eco or sustainable without actually kind of putting how it is sustainable. So does it have like recycled fibers? Is there like, you know, something that can be compostable in terms of the packaging? And then obviously the green ranges as well, which has been a big topic in fast fashion. I think I remember seeing on the ASOS website one time where they had a whole like green edit and it wasn't really precisely said like what was green. So I think that they won't be able to do that anymore. And they won't be able to kind of use very like natural looking like imagery for sustainability campaigns, which does happen a lot. You know, you get the frolicking fields, someone's kind of walking, the sunlight, like those kind of things won't be allowed. And then obviously anything to do with like environmental targets and accreditations will have to be vetted. So yeah, there's a lot of like quite hard actions. Like if this is kind of a model that other brands will have to follow, like this is quite a lot, like in terms of like authenticating what you're doing, it's almost like, you know, an audit, except it's kind of like a social audit of brands. I think it's a similar thing that's happening. Yeah, UK and EU.
Yeah. One of my favorite things that brands do is use like brown paper for their tags, which I feel like is one of those very subtle like indicators. It's like rough, unbleached paper. And it's like you kind of just assume that the whole thing must be this rustic and eco-friendly just because like the tag is made from this and it's got twine or something instead of like a plastic string. I remember one time I was in a gift shop somewhere and I found this little like stuffed toy and it had a tag like that on it with like this brown like unbleached paper. And when you look at the tag, it says this tag is made from like unbleached paper or something like that. But it was just the tag. They were only talking about the tag and the tag didn't have any information about the product. It was just like a paper tag and the tag just said this tag is made of paper. And I was like, what is the point of this other than to kind of subtly make you think that the whole product is this nice and friendly, even though that was like not at all like what was being said explicitly. So I always get a little frustrated that brands, that a lot of brands kind of like will just try it and then wait till they get a slap on the wrist from some like regulatory authority like the CMA. And what, like you're saying, it seems like the EU and the UK and in the States to a degree, like there is an actual push. But also I'm like, don't you guys want to be leaders in this too and not like be examples? Like you want to be like a conscious example rather than to be made an example of, you know? So that part's tough. And I also find it funny when brands like separate out their products and it's like this dress is ethical and the implication is that these other dresses are unethical. And I'm like, if you know how to make an ethical dress, why wouldn't you just make them all like that? I don't know. So there's a lot of, you know, confusion and annoyance as a consumer. And then also as a journalist who covers this industry a lot, I'm like, I think it would be better for you guys if you just embrace this proactively rather than being like waiting to be made to do it.
No, definitely. And I think there's a lot of that kind of wait and see approach. It was, you know, I think it's been years, to be honest, that all of these companies have been doing this before they actually got scrutinized. So I think essentially, you know, the fact that you can get 5 years of full revenues at whatever practice you were doing before outweighs all of the sustainability benefits that happen, you know, if you actually implement that from the beginning. And, you know, a lot of the kind of existing supply chains are just very, very kind of set in stone. Like no one really wants to change it. No one really wants to kind of have to do the work.
Yeah.
So yeah, that kind of ends up being a really big motivator. And I think that this is what needs to happen. Like that action between doing something and then being caught for it needs to be much faster. Like you can't wait 10 years like that. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, which is also just a function of regulation being very slow, even in a country that's, you know, really proactive about it. It's just, you know, and you can see this with AI too, not to go down like a whole other path, but like the any sort of regulation around AI is so slow, like it's so behind, you know, and that's why I think companies are trying to do as much as they can with it. And why OpenAI is kind of like so blatant about how they're using copyrighted material and stuff like that, because it's like there's no law against it now. There might be in the future. So let's just like do as much as we can with it before then. So anyway, that's a whole other topic for another day. But that's all the time we have for this week. Zofia, thank you for being here. It's always great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
And for those of you listening, don't forget to give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to this, because that helps us out so much. And don't forget to subscribe to the Glossy Podcast, because you'll hear interviews with industry insiders every Wednesday and week in review episodes every Friday. So until next time, thanks for listening.